I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome back to the EPL Roundtable. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, and as always, if you'd like to reach us to the podcast, you can do so by either tweeting us at EPL Roundtable or emailing us at eplroundtable@gmail.com.
Hey, I'm Tad, host of A Tad Predictable on EPL Index. You can find me on Twitter at TadPredicts.
Hi, I'm Dan, Arsenal fan. You can get me on Twitter at @_jersey_fits.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining me today, guys. I kind of mentioned EPL Index, but we kind of got an EPL Index reunion thing going on right now. Obviously, me and Dan used to write there, and Ted obviously hosts the show there. So a bunch of familiar faces on this one. I wanted to start kind of chronologically. Obviously, we missed the past 2 weeks, one because of a scheduling issue, one because it was the international break. But over that period, the Premier League voted to use 5 substitutes over the same kind of 3 substitution periods starting next season. So I figured we should probably start with this. What impact do you think that this will have on the Premier League at large?
From my perspective, I think it's something, especially from a Liverpool side, which Klopp has been asking for a long time. So I think he kind of feels vindicated from that. And based on how the team's been used this season, where Klopp's really relied heavily on the sports science side of things and, you know, being more methodical with when he takes players off and, you know, how many minutes players are playing to try and avoid injury, I think that just adds another layer to that in a positive way for Liverpool in being able to manage the minutes of the players, especially with the amount of games that continue to be added to the legs of all of these players. I think it's selfishly from a Liverpool's perspective, I think it's good from that perspective. And then just for the league as a whole, I know, you know, there were major concerns with regards to how much of an advantage does it give to a lot of the, you know, the bigger teams, or the maybe the teams with the bigger financial backing that will be able to build these mega squads. I guess time will tell, because the Premier League is a bit unique to other leagues from that perspective. But having seen how other leagues have introduced 5 substitutions, it's not like it's completely blown leagues out of proportion that I've seen. So hopefully that's the same with the Premier League, just a lot less injuries, a lot more, you know, management of players' welfare, not just short-term, but long-term as well. We can see these players play for a longer period of time, and then the league just stays competitive, which is what I think everybody wants.
Yeah, I'm largely in agreement with what Tad said there. As far as how much it'll help players' welfare, it definitely won't hurt. It'll probably help to an extent. I don't know how much of an extent, and they're definitely, if player welfare was the absolute priority of everything, you know, there are other ways to improve it more. Mostly, obviously, one is a winter break, but that doesn't appear very realistic right now. So this will probably help at least a little. I don't know if it'll be a major thing, but it can't hurt, for at least from that perspective. I do think it'll be an advantage to bigger clubs, because as you say, it'll incentivize clubs to be more about having depth and having just those extra couple of players to bring on as substitutes, which the bigger clubs have the resources to do that at a much better scale than the smaller ones do. So it will be an advantage. Again, how much of an advantage? I'm not sure it'll be. I don't know if it's going to be like a point a season or, you know, 5 points a season. Probably not that much, but we'll see as it goes. I think it'll be an advantage, not a massive one.
Yeah, I kind of have two main thoughts about this. Firstly, that this is probably a really bad thing for Tottenham Hotspur Football Club, who famously always have a really good 11 and not much beyond that. So personally, a bit worried. And also, when it comes to the player welfare part, I'm always wondering, like, which players will this benefit? Like, are you going to take off your star players more regularly in matches that are close because of this rule? Probably not. So maybe it gives the managers a bit more tactical flexibility, or like Tad, like you mentioned with Klopp, he can kind of watch their like heart monitors on the sideline or whatever, and decide who needs a rest at which particular moment. But I'm not really sure how this is meant to benefit players in like a match per match basis. Maybe over a full season, you'll see players playing like 150 or 200 or whatever random number fewer minutes. And that ultimately that helps in some meaningful way. But yeah, I'm just kind of curious from you guys, like, what level of player do you think this helps? Or is it just like for everyone, it's like a 10% reduction in their total minutes per season?
It'll probably help like central midfielders and fullbacks a tad more than everyone else.
Especially wingbacks with how many people are using them now.
Those specific positions are just insane. Like wingbacks are something that position is going, we'll see how it continues to evolve as it gets more important and more running all the way up and down. Like teams may just carry like two very good fullbacks for each side and try and rotate more because it's crazy on the legs. Those two positions, again, those are kind of, especially wingbacks, those are positions that aren't generally subbed that much, but Nate Bailey, now that you have five subs and you have a bit more flexibility, that is something that'll get subbed more because it is so taxing on the legs. So that position specifically, and then central midfield is the other one that, like, again, if you have a N'Golo Kante or someone of that level, you're probably not going to roll some of them off. But if you have someone who is a bit lower level and you have a closer like for like on your bench, you can kind of get 60 minutes out of one, 30 minutes out of the other just to make them both more effective. Those two positions, I would say, are probably the ones that would be helped out by this the most, because those are ones that have the most taxing on their legs.
I was thinking more in terms of the level of player that's probably going to benefit from it. And it's probably going to be those players that are trying to bridge the gap between under 23 and senior squad, because a lot of those players, you know, when I've only got three substitutions, I'm not going to put you on. I'm sorry. You know, you kind of get that feeling from managers where they'll put them on the bench, but I might not bring you on. Whereas there are a lot more opportunities, I think, to get those players a lot more experience in games. And especially, you mentioned, you know, some clubs might not have the finances to, you know, carry a squad with 18 starters in it and just rotate them. You know, a lot of development is going to have to be relied on and try and bring players through that way. But yeah, if it's positionally, I think definitely the fullbacks, because similar to where the under 23s, where you're not really bringing them on because they're only three subs, I feel like fullback is one of those positions where I need you to play the whole game, dude, because I can't afford to, in inverted commas, waste a substitution on, you know, taking you out to bring on a person that plays in that exact position where I'm asking him to do basically the same thing as you. So yeah, so from a positional standpoint, fullbacks, but from a level standpoint, I think that gap between, which has been a gap for a while in the UK, that's been an issue, is how do we bridge that gap a lot better?
Yeah, bringing up the U23s, I think, is an excellent point. I think at one point somebody proposed that those extra slots only be available to U23 players, and then somebody else, if memory serves, I'm a little dicier on this one, said something about homegrown players. And that kind of like, kind of in the way that the Bundesliga kind of came up with a bunch of rules and restructured so that the talent kind of flows through their clubs, which has made the German national team so strong, maybe trying to replicate some level of that through the substitution rule. I think the U23 one is probably the better version of that and would have been interesting, but I think you're right, Dad. I think this just might do it anyway. It just would have been an interesting way to encourage clubs to improve their youth setups and also incorporate them more into the first team. Next up, I wanted to talk about Burnley a little bit. We've talked about Everton a lot. I'm sure most people are going to be leading with Everton and are they relegation fodder and blah, blah, blah. Again, we've already done that a few months ago, so I didn't want to dredge that up again. But I don't think many people are going to be talking about Burnley, who have now lost four straight in the Premier League. I think coming into the season, a lot of people saw weaknesses in the squad and just assumed Sean Dyche would steer them to like a 12th place boring finish yet again. Hasn't really happened this season. So I was just curious from you guys, are you surprised at how heavily they're struggling this season? And what do you think their odds are of staying up?
I spoke about Burnley a little bit when I was doing my show on, I think came out on Thursday, and we're doing predictions for the weekend. And I've kind of hearkened it to pre-COVID and post-COVID Burnley. And it's still the same in terms of, if you look at the amount of goals that they're leaking, then they're not bad. you know, they've only conceded 40 goals in the Premier League so far this season. And if you look at the teams around them, the closest is Everton with 49. The rest are well above 40. They're in their 50s and 60s. So I think they've still got that Dyche character in them that they're very tough to beat. But then on the other side, the goal scoring has just seemed to dry up this season. 22 goals scored this season. It's interesting because they had Chris Wood and they've had Weghorst. And you would have thought, okay, fine, if it was Chris Wood that was the issue, okay, we brought Weghorst in. He's shown what he can do in the Bundesliga and he should favor the style of playing the Premier League. And there were flashes at the beginning with him, but it seems, I think the creativity is more of an issue. I'm looking at guys like Dwight McNeil who haven't necessarily had that step up in development. And we know development isn't linear. So it's not like every single year he's going to get better. Some years he might, you know, plateau and then there might be a big jump next year or whatever. But it seems like the support structure behind the forward player has really struggled this season. And whether or not they can stay up this season, I do think it's between, you know, I've kind of resigned Norwich and Watford to going down. And I'm looking at between Burnley and the aforementioned Everton, of the two teams, which one of them then goes down with the others. At the moment, Everton have the points. And so far this season, I'd rather have points than games in hand or anything like that because so many teams are inconsistent this season. So, yeah, it's going to be tough for Burnley to get out of that situation, I think.
Yeah, Ashley Barnes aging out for them has been really bad because they always had, it was Barnes and Wood, and Wood for their better seasons. And Ashley Barnes was very good for them for a while. And they just never really, they couldn't really replace him. Then Maxwell Cornet has had a good season, but he's been hurt for a bit. And he's also kind of crazy overperforming his expected goals. So like, as much as he's still a good player, you'd expect the goals to not go quite as much as they were going early in the season. But yeah, I think, like, not to oversimplify it to one person, but like not replacing Ashley Barnes and only having that one striker, that one Chris Wood or now Weghorst, I think it hurt them a lot. They always had Wood and Barnes, and like I said, Barnes is very good. That's been a significant problem. And as he says, Dwight McNeil not having a great season has been hurt them as well. He was supposed to be a big part of their team going forward, and he's been a part of a team, just hasn't been as good. So I'm not surprised in the sense that, like, did I pick Burnley to go down this season? No, but it wouldn't have been like, you know, it's not a crazy thing for a team that has consistently kind of hung around that just above relegation area to then have an off season and then be in the relegation race. That's not a shocking thing for a team of that, for how little money they spend and the kind of style they play. It's not entirely shocking.
Yeah, I also think, like, as a project goes, just they've been so beleaguered by injuries. I mean, they're playing what has to be a 72-year-old Aaron Lennon every match. And he's done fairly well for himself in these matches, but you just shouldn't be relying on a player like that. Obviously, good Munson head injuries. Jeff Hendrick walked. Who's that other really good central midfielder that was just never fit the whole time he was there? Stephen DeFore. It's been kind of issue after issue. I totally agree with the striking issues that both of you mentioned. I thought Weghorst would have been way more successful by now. But yeah, you don't really have many creators in that team. And if McNeil isn't on and there's no Goodmunson doing any set piece stuff or delivery from out wide, who is going to set up those goals? Is it just going to be Cornet getting into the box and then finding a striker? Because it seems like that's basically the plan. Is Cornet has to get into the box, do something, either score it or play it to Weghorst, and Weghorst isn't really scoring right now either. So yeah, it's not looking particularly good for them. Totally agree with your argument, Tad, that I'd much rather have points than games in hand. Obviously, at one stage, Tottenham had like 3 games in hand, and we're like, if we win this, we're going to finish above Chelsea, and then we lost 2 or 3 of them. I think because the Arsenal one still hasn't been played yet, so TBD on that one. But yeah, it's an interesting one, but Everton do have a really rough series of clubs left that they have to play. I probably prefer Burnley's schedule, but yeah, having the points, as you say, probably far more important this season. I wanted to talk a little bit about defenses with you guys as well. Both of your clubs, Liverpool and Arsenal, are currently top five in the league in both clean sheets and goals allowed this season. Maybe not a huge shock given the like traditional big six, although it looked like that was going to die and now it kind of feels like it's on its way right back. But I was just curious what you think is the primary cause for the strength in your defense. Is it the defense itself? Is it the goalkeeper bailing them out? Is it the midfielder? Is it the midfielders kind of dropping back and assisting in that way? So yeah, I was just curious, what do you think is the biggest strength and cause for your strong defensive statistic performances?
Yeah, I think for Liverpool, it's a combination of almost all of those things, really. We saw last season when Van Dijk got injured, our defense wasn't as strong as we wanted it to be. And it didn't help that we started moving midfielders back into center back instead of trusting some of the younger players. And Klopp's spoken about he probably should have trusted the younger players earlier on and kept the midfielders where they should be. But I think this season, everyone's playing in their correct position, so that's a good start. And then I think it's helped Liverpool that obviously VAR got introduced. It's been a couple of seasons now, but having VAR there, I think, has given Liverpool that added assurance when it comes to playing the high line, because a lot of those decisions are close. I'm looking, for example, this weekend, the two chances that were heavily focused on for Watford and could they have scored, etc. Both of those chances were offside, but they were treated as though they were onside. And obviously, no lines were drawn or anything like that during the game, because they didn't score from them, so there wasn't a need for it. But if the line, you know, having that assurance that if the lines do then get drawn, at least we know that player's offside, so you can't really count that chance. And a lot of that has happened this season. If you look at offsides this season, I think Liverpool are dominating in terms of how many offsides that they've, how many times they've caught opposition teams offside compared to the second next best team. I'm not sure what the updated numbers are now, but I do know at some point we were at least double digits over the next best team, and the next best team was City at I think a couple of months ago. So it's definitely a strength that we can rely on and have that assurance with VAR. And then also having Alisson back after you know, the previous season, we mentioned obviously the injury to Van Dijk. Alisson had a couple of injuries in that season, and then also had some personal issues as well with his father passing away. So it wasn't a really good season for him, whereas this season he seems to be back on it. So yeah, a combination of having the assurances with VAR, having obviously that defensive team that's played together for the best part of 3 years now, Alisson back to his best, Van Dijk back in centre midfield, marshalling that back line has really, really helped us out. And then, and I don't mean to step on Dan's toes on this one with regards to set pieces, because Liverpool have they hired set piece coaches, and I'm sure with Arsenal that's been a big factor for them as well when it comes to set pieces, and I'm sure Dan will speak on that. But Liverpool hiring those set piece coaches, it's not just allowed us to top the table when it comes to scoring goals from set pieces, but it's helped sort out a lot of our mistakes that we were making defensively when it came to set pieces. And when you're playing such a low scoring game like football, every little bit counts. So I think that, you know, being more secure when it comes to set pieces on a defensive standpoint has also helped cut out a lot of goals that you would usually expect to concede during the course of a season.
Yeah, as Tad mentioned, Arsenal have not conceded a goal for, I didn't forget to mention, but we've not conceded a goal from a corner, I believe, is the stat that commentators keep saying during the game, which makes me nervous. But that's been a big part of our improvement defensively. And as far as the team as a whole, it almost feels like we've done it in two different ways for the first half and second half of the season. Because the first half of the season, we were less expansive, and also Aaron Ramsdale was on a heater. Like, he was having a very, very good shot-stopping season for the first half of the season, which has leveled out a bit since. But that is kind of what I felt kept us to being a good defense for the first half of the season. Second half of the season has been more, it's almost not our defense. We've just developed a bet being better at pinning teams in and being able to continuously apply pressure and not be so vulnerable to counterattacks. So it's not so much our it's not so much the classic sitting back defending well. It's more we've not been as vulnerable in midfield to getting cut through. So I guess for if we're putting a specific part of the defense to it, our midfield has been more coherent in the second half of the season. And then for first half of the season, Aaron Ramsdale, the keeper, was doing very well.
Got it. Well, slightly jealous. Tottenham not top five in both of those things right now. You know, if you did the Conte table, you know, maybe. But anyway, impressive from both of you nonetheless. We've kind of alluded to a couple of these races a little bit already, but I just wanted to play a quick game of who would you rather be in each race. Obviously, feel free to not comment on your team if you think you're just going to say your team and kind of leave it there. But I guess, Dan, we'll kind of start off with you. Would you rather be Liverpool or City in the title race?
It's so hard. All of these races, this is a fantastic Premier League season because all of these races are so up in the air. I believe I would still rather be, I think I'd still rather be City because that game between Liverpool and City is at the Etihad. But so based on pretty much solely that, because I think both of these teams could just win all their other games because they're the two best teams in the world. They're absolutely unbelievable. So I'm going to go City specifically because that game between the two is at home for them.
Do you feel like that's fair, Ted?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it was where that game was going to be played, that second game. And as he says, it's being played at the Etihad. I think also when it comes to the Premier League specifically, I think there's more pressure on Klopp to win it than there is for Pep, considering how many Pep has won in recent history. And obviously, they both want to win every single year if they can. But I think for Klopp, it's getting to that stage where, for me, it's fine because this is one of the best, if not the best Liverpool team I've ever seen in my life. But, you know, over the course of Klopp's tenure, so to speak. But a lot of people will then start to say, okay, but what are the results of that? And it's, you know, it's, he's the fastest manager to, you know, he's gotten the most wins out of 250 games, but those 250 games don't always come in a 38-game Premier League season.
It's like how Tottenham were the best team from 2015 to 16, inarguably, but didn't win the title in either.
Exactly. So it's going to get to that stage where, okay, but are you winning trophies at the end of all this good stuff that you're doing? And I think, yeah, so I think there's a lot more pressure on Klopp and you're chasing them down. It's an away game as well. Yeah, I'm going to give the edge to City, and I would rather be in City's position at the moment.
Gotcha. Well, Ted, to avoid Dan and I having to be heinously biased, who would you rather be between Spurs or Arsenal for this top four spot?
I'm going to go with the logic of the points on the board. I'd rather be Arsenal at the moment. Look, there was a couple of, you know, back in, let's say, beginning of March, for example, you could have predicted any one of those teams in terms of, you know, Tottenham or Arsenal going and winning all their games, going and only winning two of the games, going on, like, you just don't know what these teams in terms of consistency and what they can produce. But we're starting to see a pattern with both where the teams we should be beating were starting to beat comfortably. And then it's about those other teams where, like a Crystal Palace away, where it's tricky, can you then get those ones over the line? But at the moment, I think in terms of, it was, you know, before time of recording, it was Arsenal had the points on the board. Yes, they've still got a game to play this weekend. And as we said, games in hand are dangerous. But right now, I think I'd still rather be Arsenal. I think they're playing well. They've gotten a system in place. As long as their games continue to be spread out, sort of one game a week type situations, I think Arteta's doing well at game planning for each game. It'll be interesting when the games do start piling up, when he's got two or three, you know, on the bounce, and how much training he can get done before those games, opposed to having a week to prepare for them. But yeah, I still think I back Arsenal, although it's very tricky because I think Spurs have the better coach. I just trust Arsenal's players better. Famous last words.
Why have you done this to me?
Historically, I don't know if those are famous last words. Tottenham's players is the history of Tottenham, annoyingly, as Chiellini once said. Dan, I don't know. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I I think Spurs are actually slightly better, but we actually have the same number of points right now, but we have two games in hand. So based on, I think it feels like a 55-40 and then 5% to United, because, you know, we can't technically write them off yet. But that's kind of how it feels. I think we are favorites, but not significantly. And I think it's like, so I think I would rather be us, but only slightly.
Yeah, on the Tottenham side, I'm just nervous. I think it's largely who's going to win the North London Derby whenever it's played and what happens in the Chelsea-Arsenal match, because that could really, because that's the 6 points, right? But yeah, we'll see. And Tad, as you say, sometimes it isn't down to the big sexy matches. Sometimes it's just, yeah, can Arsenal beat Crystal Palace away tomorrow? Can Tottenham beat Leicester, you know, in a few weeks from now?
I'd feel a lot better if six of our remaining 10 games weren't away. And that's some really tricky. Interesting. There's Southampton away and Palace away, the two that looking at the schedule, I was like, those are kind of scary. So that's like, if those were home matches, or even if one was a home match, I'd feel better. I'd still feel anxious, but I feel better.
Yeah, it's really, really similar to the Burnley Everton thing we were talking about earlier, because one team has the much better run-in and the other team, in theory, has the more points. But like you said, Tad, technically, as we record, Tottenham are the ones ahead of Arsenal in fourth. But yeah, Arsenal play tomorrow and then still have another game in hand after that. All right, kind of in the middle of the table, kind of battling for those European spots. Is it going to be a second Europa League spot? Is it going to be the European Conference League? I'm thinking between Wolves and West Ham, just because they have similar points, similar matches played. We're not leaving out Manchester United just because we're haters. We just figure you probably don't want the second Europa League spot. Which of these do you think is more likely to grab one of those European places?
This one was probably the hardest one for me, because over the course of a season, I usually, you know, like that adage, offense wins games, defense wins championships. But for these two teams, West Ham's offense is far superior in terms of goal scoring. And then on the other side, Wolves' defense has been far superior.
Yeah,
but
incredible.
It's been absolutely insane how well they've done. But at the moment, they just can't seem to buy goals, or at least a lot of goals in games. And that could be, I think that's going to be their undoing in this race. I think West Ham, whether or not, you know, they get past their next, do they play Barcelona, I think, in the next round in the Europa League, whether that's going to be a factor for them. But I think West Ham are in a very good moment at the moment. They've got Bowen back, which I think was very crucial for them in terms of the goals and the attacking threat that he brings as well. I think in this case, it's going to be an exception to the rule. And I think offense is going to be what rules and in terms of which one finishes ahead of the other. So I'm going to go with West Ham finishing above Wolves.
Yeah, I think West Ham is clearly the better team. I don't know how often you guys look at FB Ref, but Wolves have conceded 27 goals this season, but they have 45 expected goals conceded this season. So some of it is Jose Sa is having an incredible season. Some of it's probably a bit of luck. But at this point, there's only so many games left for that to even out. But as Tad says, they really can't score at all. So in terms of team quality, I think West Ham is just a better team. But I'm concerned that they might have just run out of gas and they might just be a bit cooked. They obviously won today. And as Tad said, getting Jared Bowen back is huge. He's very, very good. But I am concerned that they might run out of steam at the end. I'll still go West Ham because, like I said, I think they're a better team. They have a game in hand and are only a point back. But it's like all of you said, as I said earlier, this is a great season. There are so many close races. I'll go West Ham, but it could go either way.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on some of the Wolves metrics, but there's just something about the way that they play that I wonder if they're just one of those statistical outliers, like how Leicester's were like
there may be
their
some to it,
years.
But also like that is
it can't be 20 goals.
No, I see your point. It just yeah,
fair enough. Well, it'll definitely be interesting to see in future years under Bruno Lage, and then we'll kind of finish. Tad, you actually alluded to this one a little bit earlier, and I kind of made a comparison to the Spurs Arsenal race there a little bit earlier, but Burnley or Everton. Like you said, I think just we're collectively agreeing that Norwich and Watford are basically down and that the other teams around there are going to be good enough. Like 3 weeks ago, we talked about Brentford potentially, you know, being being one of the relegation race. And now they're higher than Newcastle on the table. But yeah, between Burnley or Everton, who would you favor?
So I was looking at their fixture. Obviously, the big fixture might swing this, the one on Wednesday, because they play each other. But based on the fixtures that they have left, I think 30 points may be enough, considering how the teams have played this season.
Which would be wildly low historically.
It's so low. It really is. But if you're looking at Burnley, especially in their last five games, they haven't won a game. And the game that Everton won against Newcastle, it's a 1-0 win, very close game. Could have potentially gone either way in that one as well. So I think that four-point cushion that Everton have is just, that's massive for teams that have barely won any games recently.
Burnley have three on the season and Everton.
So we're effectively giving Burnley about three wins, so to speak, to get to 30, opposed to a win and two draws for Everton. I think I favour Everton in this one, just because as I said, pre-COVID and post-COVID, Burnley are two different situations for me. And post-COVID, Burnley unfortunately just can't seem to get their attack going this season. And it seems like attack is going to be able to get you out of a lot of situations in all of these close races that we have at the moment. So yeah, I'm going to go with Everton. Also, I think there's more optimism with Everton in that Calvert-Lewin's still not fully fit. And you saw, in the game earlier today, he got taken off. He didn't get to play the whole 90. And I think they're slowly building him up. So once he gets firing, I just think there's a lot more firepower with him, with the likes of Richarlison. If Damari Gray decides to get hot again, there's just more promise there. But the only thing that's making me pause for caution is that I don't think it's unfair to say, maybe it is unfair to say, but I think Lampard's probably the worst manager in the league. And is it a situation where him being the manager of Everton becomes the detriment for them, opposed to Dyche being the manager of Burnley, and the manager kind of wins out in that situation? I think the players can get 5 points despite Lampard. And I know I'm being very harsh on Lampard, but I just don't see it with him in terms of where he is at this current point in his career. Look, he could go on to be a good manager, a great manager, but at this current point, I don't think there is a manager worse than him in the league currently. And whether or not that becomes Everton's downfall come the end of the season, I think time will tell. But at least they've got that four-point buffer. If they can get 5 points from their next eight games, I think they're going to be fine.
So I think Everton are a better team. I think they have better players, and they have, as Tad mentioned, a four-point cushion on Burnley, which is massive in a relegation race. That's a significant amount of ground. The only thing that's holding me back is the fixture lists are so, like, the gap in disparity in difficulty is just massive. Like, for people who don't have it in front of them, Burnley have Everton at home, Norwich away, West Ham away, Southampton at home, Wolves at home, Watford away, Villa at home, Spurs away, Newcastle at home. A fairly easy fixture list, only Spurs in the big six, and five home games. Everton have Burnley away, United at home, Leicester, who aren't that good this year, but still have some good players, at home, Liverpool away, which is the hardest fixture in the league, Chelsea at home, Leicester away, Brentford at home, and Arsenal away on the final day. That is a murderer's row of a fixture list. Like, it's like they may only need 5 points. If they don't beat Burnley, I don't know if they get 5 points. So all that said, I'm still going to pick Everton because I think, as I said, I think they're a better team and they have that 4 point advantage, but man, their fixture list is murder.
Yeah, which is why I was kind of bringing it up earlier in that previous comparison. Yeah, it's a really rough run in. And I think what's so fascinating, Dan, you've mentioned a few times now that it's why this season is so great, is that our race is going to heavily impact this relegation race. Because, like you said, you have Everton on the last day of the season. You also play Newcastle and Leeds. I don't think either of them are really in it, but, you know, they're both obviously clubs that are in and around that area as we speak. And then Tottenham have Burnley and Norwich the last 2 weeks, you know, assuming that the TV stations don't put Tottenham Arsenal after the last day of the season just to milk it for even more views. But yeah, it could be really telling what our race does to that race. So yeah, really fascinating to see all of that, you know, not only that, that these are all as close as they are, but that they could impact each other, kind of running down to that last wire. And, you know, there's always the chance that by then these races aren't as close as we're thinking they are now. But yeah, it's really setting up to be quite an astounding 10 final match weeks of the season. Obviously, a few clubs still have a couple more matches to play than that. We'll take a quick break now, and then we'll be back with club-specific questions for each of our guests.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
All right, and we are back. Tad, we'll start off with you talking about Liverpool. 10 straight wins has to feel pretty good. You mentioned a little bit earlier that you have all your players back playing in their natural positions. Obviously helps. Do you think that that's the primary reason behind this huge resurgence from you, or do you think it's something else?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the situation. And also being able to manage injuries a lot better this season. As I mentioned, when I was talking about the five substitutions being introduced, Klopp has been heavily relying on the sports science side of things with when to play players, how often to play them, when, you know, how many minutes to give certain players in certain games. But yeah, looking forward, and what would probably be, if I had to pick one player, say that would be the key player for me, I think the obvious ones are the Van Dijks, etc. But I would have to say Alisson, because every time we've won trophies in this iteration of Liverpool, Alisson has played a massive part in terms of just keeping us in games. So games where it's 0-0, he makes sure they stay 0-0 until we, you know, until our attack sorts itself out, for example, if we have a slow start, or if we're ahead, he just allows us to stay ahead 1-0 up until we get that second goal to give us a bit of a breather. So teams, you know, we don't concede a lot of chances to teams. We're very good at limiting the chances that teams have. But when they do get chances, you now then have to go face Alisson. And when he's playing in the form that he's currently playing at, it makes it very, very difficult for oppositions. And yeah, so as I said, we've obviously got an abundance of riches in terms of quality players, and it's first world problems, really, trying to pick one player that's important. And you look at just the spine of Liverpool, Van Dijk obviously key, Fabinho key, and then up top Salah, obviously the main man in that trio. But for me, I think Alisson playing at his peak is key for me, because no matter how good your defense is, you will always give some chances to other teams. And if they have to then face an in-form Alisson, I'll be quite confident of how well we do this season.
Yeah, that's absolutely fair. And yeah, your best 11 is frankly absurd. And then, yeah, the fact that Klopp does lean into the analytics, you mentioned the set piece coaches and stuff like earlier, like anything you can do to get an edge, you're taking, which I think is why, you know, you're so thoroughly back in this title race. And briefly, we're winning it. Had a good couple of hours there on Saturday. I also wanted to bring up the Salah stuff. I think we did that to you last time as well, so sorry about that. But reports starting to come out that he may have signed that extension. Are we buying that? And regardless, how do we feel about it?
I hope it's true. I do hope it's true, because I think if he doesn't sign and we do end up selling him, it's going to take two players to replace what he brings to the team, one for the goal scoring, the other for the creative side of things. Whether or not he signed it yet, I'm not sure. I think it was perhaps more to do with the image rights issue and trying to sort that out, because he, being a smart player, and his agent isn't really an agent, he's a lawyer, and maybe he looked into this before Salah signed for Liverpool, but he's one of the few players that we have that kept his image rights. So although Liverpool pay him, you know, if you want to say the 250,000 a week, that's just from Liverpool. And then he, with his image rights and the deals that he's able to do individually for his own individual brand, that then elevates him to become one of the highest paid players, not just in the league, but in the world, and elevates him to those Forbes top athletes lists that come up. So I think it got to a stage now with the negotiations where Liverpool were looking to then buy his image rights effectively. Obviously, he's sponsored by Adidas and our kit sponsors are Nike. And if we don't have his image rights, then that becomes a whole issue as well. So I think the club were trying to buy the image rights. Now, the discussion from Salah's side is, okay, fine, you're paying me 250. Let's just make it very basic and say, okay, increase my wages by 25,000, okay, whatever. Okay, now I'm being paid 275,000. All right, then now let's talk about my image rights. Now, his image rights are sitting and hovering around the 300,000 a week value.
Dang.
Liverpool can't afford that. Like, we can't afford that, you know, in terms of paying him over 600,000 a week. So I think that's where the difficulty came in, is Liverpool, is which side is going to buckle, or which side is going to concede, in terms of, did Liverpool just give up on the image rights issue and then just increase his wages, which they can comfortably do, the likes of, you know, like the James Milners and stuff leaving the season will free up enough money to be able to do that, or are they trying to desperately keep those, you know, trying to buy those image rights at a discount, and whether or not they can convince him to take sort of like a hometown discount. An interesting one would be if, let's say, Nike can get him on board at Nike, or, you know, if he switches boots or whatever sponsorship from Adidas to Nike, and then maybe Nike you know, take part of that deal and help Liverpool not have to pay so much in wages because he's now on like a Nike
Adidas
deal.
United deal.
Yeah, something similar to that with Pogba, you know, for example. So those, I think, are the conversations that made it a lot more complicated than what we're used to. It's not just a standard contract negotiation. There were a lot of elements that came into it, a lot of sponsors that want to have a voice that come into it. But in terms of just hometown discounts, if you look at the cost in salary per goal or assist over the last five seasons, it's quite staggering in terms of the inverted commas hometown discount, because Salah's the most value for money in terms of goals and assists currently. And I know Simon Brendish crunched the numbers and made a Twitter post on that. So if you go to his Twitter account, the numbers and stuff are there, where Salah is the most valuable, I think at like 50,980. The next closest is Lewandowski with 64,504, and then Neymar 68,122. So Salah is at least 14,000 per goal or assist more value for money than the closest person. Obviously, the highest on that list, for anyone interested, Neymar is at 162,050. So over 100,000. More you're paying him in terms of value for goals and assists in that calculation. But yeah, go check out Simon Brundish's Twitter for that kind of stuff. It's really cool to see. So I don't think Salah's being unfair. I think he's saying, pay me what I'm worth. If you do want the image rights, okay, pay me what my image rights are worth. And I don't think that's a conversation that can be started unless Nike get involved, in my opinion. And I don't see why Adidas would easily give up Salah to Nike without putting up some sort of fight. So yeah, it's a lot more complicated than has been implied in the newspapers and in the tabloids. Whether or not he signed it, if he has, it's great. If he hasn't, I would be quite upset, because I think having Salah on board, especially now whilst Klopp is still there, and then in 2 years' time when Klopp does leave Liverpool is going to be key. We need players that have been there with Klopp, have hopefully gone and won, you know, not just trophies in the past, but trophies over these next 2 years, that could then, when a manager comes in, they're not coming in with brand new players that don't know the culture of the club, so to speak, the standards that are being, that are asked to be set. It makes the transition a lot easier. And then the last thing I'll say is, with regards to some of the young players that we brought in, the Harvey Elliotts, we got Carvalho coming in from Fulham. I think that deal's been confirmed, or at least it will be confirmed soon enough. There are some, you know, Luis Diaz coming in January. If we have Salah there as the role model for how to be, you know, a player that's competing to be a world-class player or competing for Ballon d'Ors, you ask for the work ethic for Salah. He's one of those first one in, last one to leave type of situations. His diet is impeccable. His gym work is ridiculous. Like, if he can be at the club showing those guys, the Diazes, et cetera, how to then be great. If then Salah leaves after a couple of years of Diaz training with him, I'm happy for Diaz to try and take that mantle and be, you know, the Salah replacement, so to speak, because his numbers at Porto, they matched up really well to Salah's numbers when Salah was at Roma. So that's an exciting thing to from that perspective. But he needs to now train with the guy that's been there and done it. So I think it will be a mistake from a long-term development of maintaining Liverpool standards if we let Salah go now. But as I said, it's not as easy, unfortunately, when a player is smart enough to keep their image right and then goes and performs at an elite level like he has.
Gotcha. Yeah, you have a really interesting choice to make there. And obviously, I have so much trauma from hearing the word image rights that many times after that was what caused the Dybala to Tottenham move fall through. But Dan, you're kind of in a similar-ish situation. And for you, it's like the third or fourth big player in a row you've had to deal with, which is Alexander Lacazette, who wasn't really providing goals or assists the first half of the season. And then basically the second half started, decided to have 8 assists in 10 matches. Pretty impressive. Curious your thoughts on his current role, how he's playing in the team, and if this has put you in another weird contract situation.
The thing that would put us in a weird contract situation is the fact that if we let him go, we'd have to sign 2 strikers more so than his play. I think Lacazette's pretty cooked. Like, he has 7 assists this season, but it's off 1.9 expected assists. That's not going to keep up. I think his link play is good, but it's been overstated by the ridiculous number of assists he had in a number of games. He has 2 non-penalty goals this season. He is getting less than 2 shots a game. He's not a good enough starting striker at all. The only real place where I think he would the only reason I'm even considering being open to a contract extension, not that I'm making decisions, but is, again, like I said, because if we don't re-sign him, we have to sign 2 strikers. So if he is open to a backup role on a 1, maybe a 2-year deal, I would consider it. But as I said, I think he's pretty cooked. So even a 2-year deal, I would be pretty hesitant to give him, because I think it could be pretty much immovable. He could just be a negative player pretty soon. He's shown age. He is very slow now. He is a useful guy to help connect the team. But ultimately the number one, two, and three job as a striker is to get shots and to score goals. And he just doesn't do that. He has not done that this season at anywhere near a good enough level. He's a below average striker when it comes to shots, only just, but he's about average for like Premier League average, not top 6 average, like Premier League average. He's just not good enough to be the starting striker on a team that has aspirations of a top 4. And even as a backup who could decline, even that concerns me. So as far as should we give him an extension, it really depends on what we can do for a backup striker as an alternative. I'm not that concerned either way. If we let him go, that's fine. If we extend him, that's going to bring me some anxiety, but it could be fine. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, I'm just fascinated with how many times this has happened. But I guess to your point, he isn't, in theory, the key player that, say, you know,
yeah, I would put in an entirely different category. Like, I think, like, he should not be the one pressuring us for a contract. Like, he should be hoping he gets a contract from us because, yeah, I'm not even sure he's Europa League level quality striker at this point.
He's not a Premier League.
Yeah.
Totally. And you mentioned some stats there. I know you're a big fan of stats. We were kind of talking before the show about how all of our clubs are on pretty impressive runs right now. Arsenal, obviously, part of that list. And I was just curious if this is the final, like, Arteta turning point, if the stats are kind of saying the same thing that the results are, where does that all kind of sit right now?
We probably are playing... I don't know. In terms of, like, our performances, we have just been straight up good for the past 3-4 months. We've simply been good. I was a bit wary of it in December because that tended to coincide with we played a bunch of teams who were like we played Leeds with who had like a 15-year-old on the bench who were not playing a real team. That kind of helped them. We played Norwich, who are terrible. So like that was kind of wary of it. Then at this point, I just think we might be good. I am somewhat wary of it because like we just became good. There's no obvious like thing to point to like, oh, this is why things have changed. Because like with Spurs turned around significantly because, oh, Conte became manager.
If you hire one of the five best managers in the league, you tend to get better, turns out.
Like that's a very clear, okay, this happened because like X happened because Y. There isn't really that with Arteta. We just kind of like, well, we were average and now we are playing well. But we are objectively playing well, and we have the way you could explain it is like the young players have just gotten better and also become more familiar with the system, which is it that would make sense if it was more gradual improvement. The fact that it's radical improvement, again, I'm a bit wary of how real that is, but it's definitely real to some point, and we are just clearly good. Like at this point, we're going to give Arteta an extension at the end of season, and I'm okay with that, which is not something I would have thought I'd be saying 6 months ago. I'm okay with that. Is he a world-class manager? I don't think so, but I definitely don't think he's a negative anymore. So I'm fine with giving him an extension. He could get better. Like he's still pretty new in his coaching career. Like that's a pretty radical turnaround for me, for anyone who's been a longtime listener of his podcast. Is this level of play 100% real? I don't know. Is it 85-90% real? Yeah, I think so. So that's pretty great.
Yeah, and I think the combination of young manager and young squad historically has been a pretty good choice. I would just assume that in those contract negotiations, you'd give yourselves a pretty easy out the way Tottenham have had to start doing instead of paying like five managers at a time. As we just marry you around our way through them. Because I think if you had like a dual option where like if he ends up actually being a world-class manager, somebody could come buy him out of the contract. But if he's terrible, you could cut him in 2 years and not have to owe him any money afterwards. I think that might be something that would kind of benefit both parties. Yeah, but I agree
I believe he's 1 year after this. And I would expect it to either be a 2 or 3 year extension. I don't think we actually had any like solid rumors for the details of the contract extension. Yeah. But it's going to I will be shocked if it does not happen. There has been some rumors that they've been in talks, and I'd be shocked if it doesn't happen. So
true. And I do think there's a small chance for both clubs that whoever falls short between Tottenham and Arsenal could have a real negative impact on their general momentum. Because I think right now, if you looked at both sides will probably finish higher next year than they're going to this year. But that can always cause some weird emotional stuff, and I'm loath to say it because it's mentioned on literally every single Tottenham match, even when you're winning 5-1, for example. But if Tottenham miss out on Champions League, does it have an effect on Conte and or Kane? Which I'm not sure there's the same fear at Arsenal at present. We'll wrap up with player watch. And I was just curious, you know, as we keep talking about all these objectives that our clubs are kind of chasing, which player at your club do you most need to step up if you are to reach your objectives within the season? So for Tad, that'd be obviously the title, and you're obviously still in the Champions League, and then Dan and I, you know, more that top four.
I suppose that's slightly different. Hey, to in terms of stepping up, maybe then a player that's not necessarily firing on all cylinders, whereas Alisson would have been my choice, but I think he is playing really well. So stepping up, it would probably have to be between Firmino and Henderson. Firmino, just because he hasn't played that much football this season for us. He's been thrown into specific games at certain points in time, especially for the defensive work that he does from the front, as weird as that may sound. But especially, for example, in the Man City game, I'm pretty sure he's going to start that game just because we need the defensive work that he does, where he harasses the other team's midfielders to, you know, kind of disrupt them having a tempo and controlling the game. So if he's starting that game, having not played so often for us this season, he has to hit the ground running, so to speak, and he has to put in a big performance. So, and then on the other side, Henderson, he's not had the best of seasons. He started playing better in the second half of this season. And if he can continue doing that, I think that will be important, because as the club captain, he's probably going to play a lot of games coming up, and obviously very heavily managed, because he does have a few injury problems, like long-term problems that will continue to affect him throughout his career. So he will be monitored, but that makes it hard for a player to then, when you're not in rhythm, when you can be managed to a certain point, and you can't always guarantee that you're playing every game, depending on how you're reacting to training and games and stuff. Maybe that can be hard. So yeah, between those two, if I had to pick one, I'd probably say Firmino, because I can see him being thrown into some really crucial games. And he's going to be judged unfairly, because the standard's going to be, you have to give 8, 9, 10 out of 10 performances in those games, because they're so crucial for us. Whereas he wouldn't have gotten enough games to play himself into a good rhythm. So yeah, Firmino's going to have a big role towards the end of the season.
I don't know, in big matches, just play Origi if it's me, but you know, whatever.
it's guaranteed 3 goals. So yeah, that seems easy. Like a good tactic.
Light work. Dan, who needs to step up there for Arsenal?
Well, I already burned all my stats on him, but it's Lacazette. He works very hard, and he has helped the team a good amount these last couple of months, but he does just need to score at least a couple goals. That would be really helpful. Because having just no goals from your striker is really hard to overcome. We have done it because Saka has been on fire. Martinelli's been good. Smith Rowe's been chipping in with goals. We've been able to overcome it, but ultimately it's going to be really tough for us to be where we want to be if Lacazette doesn't at least chip in with some goals. So he's the guy in terms of stepping up. There are other guys who we need him to maintain their levels, but in terms of stepping up, it's Lacazette. I don't even think there's another answer.
Yeah, and for Spurs, I'd say it probably has to be Emerson or Reguilon. Reguilon picked up a knee injury in training on Friday. And of course, as soon as you hear knee injury, you know, we might not hear again from him until like freaking November. But if he's okay, I'd say Reguilon. And if Reguilon's just out because of injuries, then I'd say it has to be Emerson. Because if we're going to play Doherty at left wing back, which worked incredibly well today, then Emerson really needs to step all the way up at right wing back, where he has just been tragically poor this year. And I feel for him, because he was brought in to play the right side of a 4-4-2, which he was familiar with. And now we're like, you have to be a wing back. But there are like basic things. It was like my earlier complaints about Doherty, where it's like, he's not being played in the right position. You're like, does that prevent him from being able to play a 5-yard pass? I'm kind of there right now with Emerson Royal. Got on the score sheet today, actually marked Saint-Maximin fairly well. But yeah, hopefully he'll be able to step it up. And if Reguilon's fit, then it's not an issue, because Matt Doherty is all of a sudden good. And the concern would be at the other wingback position. All right, that's where we will wrap things for today. If you guys would like to tell folks where they could find you or anything you're working on, now would be a good time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Kev. I'm Tadio Chinakira, as I said, host the A Tad Predictable podcast on EPL Index. You can find all the other work that I do on Twitter at @TadPredicts.
Thanks for having me on. You can still get me on Twitter at @the_jersey_fits.
Yeah, and I'm your host, Kevin DeVries. You can find me on Twitter at Kevroff. You can find the show at EPL Roundtable on Twitter. You can email us at EPLRoundtable@gmail.com, and you can just type EPL Roundtable into all of your podcasting doodads. But we'll leave things there. Thanks again to these two for coming on, and folks at home, we hope you keep listening.